there's a growing population of homeless people who live on the streets of Philadelphia. In the winter, they keep warm by lying on steam vents or finding shelter in doorways or in the subways. They're sometimes called bag people, since the few possessions they have, if they have any, and whatever they've collected during the day, is carried with them in a bag. We're going to spend the first part of Fresh Air today discussing the personal and social conditions that force people to live on the streets, how they survive there, and whose responsibility it is to care for them. I have three guests with me. Bill Eisenhuth is the founder and director of the Philadelphia Advocates for the Mentally Disabled. You may have read about him recently in the Philadelphia Inquirer. For years, he's been traveling through Center City streets during the night, providing food and hot drinks for street people. This work started in New York in the 1960s, and he still pays visits to New York, working with the street people there. He also works at a suicide prevention and crisis counseling center. Pamela Kilman is a lawyer who is a founding member of the Philadelphia Advocates for the Mentally Disabled. She formerly worked as a social worker with mental patients in a state hospital. She also did crisis intervention with psychiatric emergency patients. My third guest is Liz Robinson, and she's the director of the People's Emergency Center in West Philadelphia. This is an emergency shelter for women, families, and couples. And before I introduce Pam and Bill, I'd like to speak for a few minutes with Liz. Liz, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You are one of the groups that provide emergency assistance for people. How capable are you of dealing with the problems of street people in the West Philadelphia neighborhood that you work in?
All the emergency shelters in Philadelphia are very short-term in the amount of care and time length of care that they can provide. Our shelter has the standard two-week shelter limit, which means that a person can only stay there for 2 weeks within a year's period. So you can see immediately that the emergency shelters are very ill-equipped to deal with the long-term problems of the population, which is chronically homeless. These people are often in and out of a number of different housing situations. Soon after their release from a state hospital or other mental institution, they may be housed temporarily in a boarding home, may find it very difficult to adapt to a boarding home environment, may find the level of care not even sufficient to meet their needs, or it may in fact be less than they were receiving in a mental institution. So they may leave. They may just wander off and leave the boarding home, and then they're out in the street and completely ill-equipped to deal with the society that greets them on the street. In West Philadelphia, we see a population which varies. Many of the people we see normally spend most of their time in Center City. Our shelter, again, only serves the single woman and not the single man, so that the single women somehow seem to collect more frequently in the Center City area. We can provide them very short-term services and endeavor to get them back into at least a boarding home, if not have addressed the deeper, more long-term problem of the mental health needs that they will have for the rest of their lives.
Although I know that there's a problem with a shortage of beds and medical care available for street people, I've heard, on the other hand, that many of them do not seek the assistance that they can get and prefer to be left alone on the street and don't come looking for any assistance. What kinds of people come to your center and seek out emergency assistance?
Well, we have a combination of people who will come on their own, and these are usually people who are really more adaptive to a boarding home environment and want to remain indoors. The second group would be people who are brought in by others. Those may be brought in by a curious passerby who's getting on the subway at 11th and Market and happens to run into a lady who obviously is in pain and needs to be indoors in the wintertime. And that person might bring them to a shelter. And then the third group are people who are brought in by police. The police in Philadelphia now are having to... it just seems that most neighbors, when they look out their window and see a chronic street person literally on their step, they're affronted by it and want the person removed and will call the police to do that job. And the police then have to figure out where in the world to take this person. And many times those people are in very, very bad physical shape. And we've had people in this winter who cannot even stand, who cannot walk. It's just a miserable kind of condition.
Well, what can you do for them when they come like that?
Well, fortunately, I don't know if I should say this on the air. I don't think I should. There are several hospitals in Philadelphia who will respond to that level of difficulty and will address the problem and resolve it for that particular population.
You know the feeling that you get when you see someone who's obviously very sick and homeless on the streets, and you wonder, gee, can I do anything? And say you decide to bring them to a shelter like yours, are you doing the right thing?
Yes, I think so. If that person chooses to go with a stranger and will even engage in conversation with a stranger and respond to the suggestions that are given, that person clearly wants to seek a better solution for their problem. And People's Emergency Center is one place where they can receive immediate, if not treatment, then help.
If someone backs away from you and waves you off or says something that makes it clear they don't want your assistance, should you accept their word for it, do you think?
Well, it's a matter of judgment and how much experience you have with the population. If you have no experience with the population, I think that you should accept that person's right to determine the distance he wants to keep from a stranger. If you have more experience, and you let your experience judge be the judge for you.
How would you rate the medical and care services that are available to the homeless in Philadelphia?
Generally, grossly overworked. The Philadelphia Health Management Corporation did a study after the PGH closed years ago, and their conclusions were, this is a group of hospital administrators who are all getting flooded and deluged with requests for help for the chronically homeless. Their emergency rooms are one of the places where people will wind up on the most bitter nights. And they're just, you know, not appropriate. An emergency room is not an appropriate place for them. So in order to try to address the problem, the study was done to determine how many beds are needed and what form of facility would be most helpful to address the problem. Their conclusions were that more of a halfway house was absolutely essential to begin to address the problem. Not a boarding home, but a facility which was designed and geared for this particular chronically mentally ill population that's now on the street.
There are some hospices in Philadelphia and, of course, in many other cities that are operating from a religious perspective, and there is frequently a religious message that accompanies the assistance that someone can seek there. What do you think of that combination?
I don't think it really does anyone finally much good. It doesn't seem to make any long-term converts to the faith, and it also, I don't think it delivers any higher quality of service. And I think people's immediate needs are so basic and so direct that the relief of those emergency needs is the business at hand, and any other message that's trying to be communicated is really superfluous and may in fact interfere.
Can you tell us, Liz, how to get in touch with the People's Emergency Center?
Sure. The People's Emergency Center is housed in a church at 3311 Chestnut Street, and the phone is 382-7522 or 21.
Thanks very much, and we'll be hearing more from Liz as we continue our conversation. I want to introduce now my other two guests to you. With me is Bill Eisenhuth, who's the founder and director of the Philadelphia Advocates for the Mentally Disabled, and he has been working in Philadelphia and in New York, roaming the streets, taking care in some respects of street people, helping to provide hot drinks and food for them, and he's done a considerable amount of reading and study in the area of street people and how they got to be homeless. Also with me is Pam Kilman, and she is a lawyer, a founding member of the Philadelphia Advocates for the Mentally Disabled, and she'll be talking to us also about some of the legal aspects of what led to the homeless life that many people are leading now. Welcome, both of you, to Fresh Air. Bill, I'm interested in asking you first how this became such an interest of yours. You're devoting, it seems to me, your personal hours off the job trying to provide some food to people who have no other source of food except garbage cans.
That's right. I have a long-term interest in the chronic schizophrenic from state mental hospitals that I've worked with, and early on followed many of the patients up that I had worked with in state mental hospitals, either into boarding homes or single-room occupancy hotel rooms. and just kind of followed them from there into the streets, and then realized that they were in dire need of further help and were unable to receive it because of the present laws that exist or policies of state hospitals not to allow direct returns unless the patient goes through the community mental health center or hospital bed in the community, which are normally shut down to this type of patient. I developed that in New York early on, as you indicated, and then kind of started in the streets of Philly. Just followed several patients up, and that led me to others in the process.
Well, what about you, Pam?
Well, I have a long interest, too, from working in a state hospital and from having seen patients before they were released. And certainly when I met Bill, I was really impressed with the work he was doing and with his concern for the people who are living in the streets now and in boarding homes as well with no care.
Bill, you referred to how you followed many people from state hospitals to being on the streets. Now, whenever I run into someone on the street who's obviously living there, I wonder how they got there. And, you know, you make up your own history, but you really have no way of knowing how they got there. The people who you trace from a hospital to the street, can you give us like an outline of the events that would lead for that kind of transition?
Sure. I strongly feel that many of the patients have been dumped and or inappropriately placed in situations that they just simply can't function in because of their mental illness, which exacerbates under extreme pressure many times, or when they go off the kinds of medications that are offered in hospitals. Patients will be placed in a boarding home that might be intolerable to them. Their living quarters might be too restrictive in that they're closed in too much, and many of the people like to pace. They like room to walk. And they're placed quite often in areas that they are culturally deprived from experiencing in their earlier days. In other words, they may have been in a hospital 20 to 50 years, let's say. So that they're institutionalized, they are suffering from a severe mental illness, and they're culturally not equipped to handle the new community that they're placed in. The boarding home operators quite often are not equipped to understand the dynamics of their illness and become very upset and impatient about this. Now, the particular situation that often results in the patient being put out in the streets is the patient decompensates. The boarding home operator may, out of concern, contact a mental health clinic and say that so-and-so is very ill, very upset, they're hallucinating, they're not sleeping at night, they're burning holes in the floor with their cigarettes, and we need someone to come over and see them. As Liz indicated, these services are severely overloaded now with various kinds of intervention and psychiatric emergencies, so that the service will often say at a crisis center or a mental health clinic, we'll bring the patient in. The boarding home operator may not be able to get the patient, who is now resistive to anything at all, maybe very paranoid, very frightened, into the clinic. So there becomes a deadlock. At that time, the boarding home operator may legitimately find they can no longer keep that person there, and they may trade that patient or person off to another boarding home and switch someone around that's less likely to be disruptive, or simply put the person in the street. Now, when that individual is placed in the street, they may leave without identification, they may leave without a new address, they may leave without their Medicare or their medical assistance card, and they'll often shuffle into Center City and I'll meet them there. And at that time, of course, they've really, I use the word decompensated, but they've regressed back to a stage where they're not able to insightfully understand what's happening to them, and their judgment gets severely impaired. And then we see them obviously get into situations where they become lice infested. They often will get gangrene from the cold, and their ulcerated legs get worse, and they'll just be in very, very poor condition, as Liz indicated. And coupled with that, of course, is the illness itself that prevents them from understanding that there has to be some intervention on their part, or willingness to let someone intervene on their part, which is often interpreted as a threat to their life, or they're very paranoid many times, and they will resist this, and they keep getting worse and worse.
Liz Robinson of the People's Emergency Center, you're nodding your head. Is this
yes? It's very clear.
This confers with your experience.
Yes, exactly.
Pam, what does the law say about who has the right to state hospitalization and who does not?
Well, I think the law is very clear in Pennsylvania that the state is mandated to provide psychiatric care for anyone who's in need. In reality, that doesn't happen, and for many years there has been a focus on people's rights to liberty rather than their needs. And I think what happened was that the idea of deinstitutionalization became very popular, and people for a long time, I think, genuinely felt that it was better for people, if they wanted to be independent, to live in the community. I think in reality, very seldom do their needs get met. I mean, they're very often placed inappropriately, and there really aren't the kind of community services that would be needed. The problem is, once a person gets out and does, as Bill says, decompensate, it's very difficult to get them back into the system. While there is a provision in the Mental Health Act for someone to be involuntarily committed if they're unable to care for their most basic needs and are in danger, it's very seldom utilized, at least in Philadelphia County. And there is a severe bed shortage at this point, which makes it, even when a person is appropriately committed, very often there's no bed. And unfortunately, many of those people are simply returned to the streets, even after the proper legal procedures have been taken.
There's a law now that says that you can't commit someone against their will in a psychiatric institution, yes?
Well, the law as it exists now states that a person should or must be dangerous to self or others to be involuntarily committed. However, there's a Section B under that same law that the lawmakers deliberately put in there to help the kind of person we're talking about, that states if a person is so unable to care for themselves that they are likely to meet with serious physical debilitation or danger or decompensation or death within 30 days, then they are legally allowed to be reevaluated or brought into a facility for evaluation. That is pretty much ignored in this county for two reasons, as Pam cited. Number one, if this was recognized, they would be deluged by literally hundreds and hundreds of recognizably, diagnosably ill people, both physically and mentally. And secondly, after the deluge in the crisis centers, there wouldn't be any beds. Coupled with that is there are no direct admissions back to a state hospital after they're out 30 days. They must do 26 days in one of the private providers' beds, such as Hahnemann, Jefferson, Temple, etc. So that knowing that, the people in the crisis people in the front lines are going to be very, very resistive to allowing these people in. Consequently, even after trying maybe for several hours to get a patient like this a bed and find that they can't get them in for one reason or another, they'll quickly learn that this is very, very bad for them and for the emergency room and for the time that it consumes, so that the gatekeepers, so to speak, resist more, and that message gets backed up further and further.
So the message I'm getting from you is that you think it was a mistake to, in the first place, let out so many people from the state hospitals.
Well, the whole idea of deinstitutionalization is an excellent one, and one of care and concern, and the obviously desire to make the living conditions better for most of these people. However, I believe it would be correct to say, from psychiatric studies, that after the top level of patients were released from state hospitals and probably fairly well placed with some follow-up, the states became aware of the fact that it was not only a good publicity thing, but economically it would save literally thousands and thousands of dollars in mental health budgets for each state hospital, and it would be much cheaper to maintain a person in the community on an SSI check over and against providing $150 a day or whatever it might be for the person in a state mental hospital.
Okay, we'll get back to some of the legal questions involved here and some of the questions of who is or who should be providing care for people who are now homeless. But I want to talk with you a little bit about what it's like, what kind of survival techniques people have to fall back on who are living on the street. I know when I was young and I'd walk around the streets of Manhattan, most of the people who were homeless seemed to be alcoholics. You could smell it on their breath and you can hear it in the way they spoke. And you'd always be confronted by someone who'd, you know, introduce themselves and then ask you for a dime. In certain parts of Manhattan, people would start to wash your windshield and then put their hand out and ask for some money in return, or, you know, can I have a dime for a cup of coffee or whatever. And with street people now, it seems to be a completely different situation. You don't get asked for anything. They don't seem to be alcoholic. Bill, what do you think are some of the the kind of common behavioral patterns that you find amongst street people now?
Okay. The major problem, of course, is the person isolates themselves. Severely mentally disturbed people tend to be very frightened of others, frightened of relationships. And for us, perhaps, nothing ventured, nothing gained, but for them, nothing ventured, nothing lost. They just simply can't tolerate any more rejection in the relationship, so that they'll isolate themselves. And when there is no human contact, obviously, the person becomes more withdrawn and more innerworldly, shall we say. And they live in a definitely closed-off world to the outside people. And consequently, they look more shabby. Incidentally, that's not a problem because most of these people would dress this way in a state hospital. So one should not be alarmed necessarily about the shabby clothes or mismatched clothing and things. This is a trait that most schizophrenics have. However, what happens, again, is the level of survival becomes much more difficult. So that, let's say, early on, a patient may have survived by being in Reading Terminal all night or Amtrak's 30th Street Station or the Greyhound Terminal. As these places have become more sensitive to public opinion and complaints from passengers, they've made policies that at a certain hour of the night, the terminal either closes, or if a person doesn't have a bus or train ticket, they must leave. So the functioning level then regresses further and goes to a street vent, inside of a garbage can or a trash receptacle. And unfortunately, many are picked up in the morning and compacted into some of the trucks. We've had that happen. And their level of survival just simply becomes more primitive. In other words, it's just a matter of how not to freeze to death, how to eat enough out of a garbage can many times and survive from that, which brings in some other problems we might mention, like food poisoning, hypothermia, and things like this.
As the population has increased, have more places begun shutting down their doors, as you mentioned, like terminals closing down?
Absolutely. Because
there's, I guess, more people who would be there at night. It's
Absolutely.
Not a question of one or two anymore. Yeah.
In Port Authority Terminal in New York, which is one example, in July of 79 compared to February of 79, in July of 79 there were approximately 80 patients that could be seen in the terminal. In the winter, however, it would go up as high as 200 to 300 shuffling in and out within a few hours, which overloaded the police department, obviously, and they had to chase them back out into the cold streets.
A lot of times when you're passing by someone who's living on a vent, they might be talking to themselves mm-hmm. or making sounds that aren't really language, mm-hmm. quacking
That's
sounds
right.
or clucking
mm-hmm.
sounds. Is that, do you think, a symptom of the psychiatric problem that they have? Would that be a symptom of schizophrenia?
Yeah, it's a symptom, at least, of severe mental illness. Not all are diagnosably schizophrenic. Many are suffering from what we call chronic brain syndrome or other severe organic problems. However, predominantly they are diagnosably, they were at least clinically schizophrenic in mental hospitals. And the obvious hallucinations do take place when they're more isolated. And one of the approaches to that kind of person is to kneel down near them first and try to establish some kind of relatedness initially and try to get closer and sit with them on the vent or try to break through the hallucinatory material and get them to talk with me. I can find their level of functioning by doing that.
Now, how do you do that?
Well, kneel down near the person. If I don't know them, I give the little distance to make sure I can break through whatever is happening to them and ask permission to talk with them. I feel they deserve that dignity. If they're not going to, I try another route, which is usually food. And most people you can appeal to through their oral needs and their hunger. So I'll kneel down by a vent or a trash can or a garbage can and ask permission to speak and tell them why I'm there, that I'm very concerned about what's happening to them. And I'll ask them questions that will reveal their mental status to me, how severely psychotic they might be. And then on that basis, I try to establish a relationship that I build over a period of weeks or months.
What's your goal in doing that, to keep them alive a few more days, or is this part of a larger study that you're mm-hmm. working on, documenting the problem?
Actually, both. First of all, to see how severely disabled they are, both physically and mentally. And if they're really bad, we obviously try to do something both mentally and physically, which we can get into, which presents another major problem. The second part is, I think one has to realize that when it's 5 degrees below and the wind's blowing, it's even colder, and it's important that they have warm clothes because some just are not aware of the cold. and will often be, you know, get frostbite or whatever from the exposure. So we've been going around over the period of the year here with this particular winter with clothes and a car and gloves and socks and things like that. Many are in stocking feet and things like that.
What kind of reaction do many passerbys in Center City, for instance, give to the people who are obviously living on the street? Is there much? Are they in danger much of being mugged, or do they get a lot of attention from people? Food, perhaps.
The difficulty in answering that is it ranges all from very much very deep concern for the person to strictly terrific anger. And it'll range from one person to the next like this. In New York, for instance, I've often intervened on a person who would be taunted or threatened by someone and tried to then logically deal with this individual and explain why the person is acting bizarrely in the middle of Times Square or something.
I remember a few years ago, there were so many people who were in the process of making movies about bad people. I think that everybody just noticed what was happening and wanted to just document it in some way or make some kind of statement about it. And I remember in discussing it with a friend of mine who was interested in I think, doing a movie, that she said, yeah, it's interesting, the men seem to be alcoholics and the women seem to be bad people. Mm-hmm. What causes that distinction? Liz, have you noticed ever a distinction like that? Does that ring any bells?
My experience is very similar to Bill's, in that the people that we see, almost without exception, are not and never have been alcoholic.
That's right.
And they're not the traditional classic street bum. They are a chronically mentally ill person whose needs are certainly not, you know, being appropriately met on the street. I'd like to add something to what Bill was saying earlier about the response of the person on the street. In West Philly, near the university area, there are several people there who've been adopted by the university, and there's one man who's called the Vent Man. And he is at a certain corner every day, almost every day of his life. And that person has been adopted by the student population as someone that they will care for. And there are students who have taken him in and fed him and housed him when it was a danger for him to be on his own. But on the other, at the other extreme, is a person, and that person might normally be a, you know, somewhat sensitive individual, but who might have their child with them. And sometimes the reaction of a child to a foreign being, and many of these street people appear quite foreign to the naive eye, is repulsion and anger, as Bill mentioned. Mm-hmm. And that, I think for that kind of response to become more characteristic is a very dangerous thing. I think that the approach that needs to be taken is one of understanding first and appropriate help. Rather than the reaction of repulsion and anger is really very inappropriate and detrimental to both parties.
You know, I'd be interested in your reactions to this, but I know what's been most frightening to me lately is that sometimes I'll look at someone and think that they're a friend of mine, because so many people look like someone who you know, and you walk a few steps closer, see a little closer, and realize that they're homeless and that there's something really crazy about them. You'll look into their eyes and see this agitated but vacant look, and it's so disturbing. Mm-hmm. And when I was young, I never felt that because I wasn't old enough to feel that kind of connection with someone. But I feel like I have a lot of peers out there now. A lot of my contemporaries are living on the street, and it's frightening in a way for me than it's ever been before. Do you ever feel that way, that you're like almost seeing yourself or your friend out there, that there's this connection? Mm-hmm.
I agree, and I think if I might add to that, unfortunately, psychiatry today is being bound in its efforts to help in relation to a patient being either dangerous to themselves or others, and that is very, very tragic, because one should not have to wait until one has created mayhem or hurt someone to receive the help that would be very appropriate and available to them. And the kind of person you're describing, with the vacant look, somewhat crazed eyes at times, are very suspicious and paranoid, are, you know, there's help available for those people, and the misery that they live in is unbelievable in many, many cases.
How can you communicate about the misery? What I'm trying to figure out is that, since a lot of people, from what I understand, will try to feel so alienated and paranoid that they'll try to maybe turn down your assistance or will wave you away. They'd rather be alone. How can you determine what it is that they're experiencing and what their preference would be in terms of assistance, or if they're not noticing the cold, is the cold making them suffer? If they don't feel it.
Well, I think the loneliness is probably the worst of all. As I've gotten to know the people over the years in the streets and had gained their trust, loneliness is the key thing, and the isolation. And yet out of that comes a very psychotic presentation of why they're lonely and why they're isolated. As I indicated earlier, the fear of relationships and closeness is so frightening that they'd rather suffer the loneliness than have the relatedness, which is essential and important in any human being. So that suffering in itself is tragic enough. And the other tragedy that exists is there is really very appropriate help, and needs could be met through the services that are now existing.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and it doesn't take long to realize, if you're with these people for a while, that the cold does affect them in a different way, perhaps, and the lice that they're continually grabbing and scratching are driving them crazy. They can't sleep over the steam vents, even though they're there. And one realizes, after one sits on a steam vent with a patient for a while, that it's only the lower part of their body that's really warm. When it's windy and cold, the chest and head are exposed and very, very cold. And just the sheer problem of getting food, many will panhandle, and many will eat out of garbage cans. And that's considered a form of survival, and many people say if they can do that, they're taking care of themselves. But after you live with them for a while and hear their stories and realize where they are mentally, you really know that that's not survival. It's just, well, it is. It's an existence that's just above the most primitive that we can imagine.
Liz mentioned the people at the University of Pennsylvania have adopted some of the street people there. And they have nicknames, and they're given food, sometimes temporary shelter. Does anything like that exist in Center City?
Yeah, there are many, many people that will be given things regularly. However, there are so many new people that come through. For instance, the other night I was talking to a man from Columbus State Hospital. Earlier on in the week, one from Napa State Hospital in California, St. Elizabeth's in Washington. These people roam, they get lost, and they get out of their what we call a catchment area. And once that happens, you see they're not entitled to the treatment that they deserve. May I just give an example? Let's assume that I have someone that's from an area that we can't identify. We do not know the address. Person has no identification, no MA card. If that person's taken into a psychiatric facility, unless you can identify the catchment area, you're really going to have terrific difficulty getting them any kind of services, no matter how bad they are. And I'm talking about gangrene and things like this, because they're not identifiably from that area, you see. So it's pretty much a shut door for them. And if it were not for people giving them food and perhaps at times, as Liz said, adopting them, which is really rare, and I think it's the sympathetic student that might do that, that's somewhat sensitized to this, they would really be in much worse condition than they are.
Do you think it's a good idea to try to leave food for people?
Oh, absolutely, sure. In fact, since the article in the Inquirer, I've noticed a lot of the patients that I'll go back to see will have blankets.
Oh, that's
terrific. Hoagie will be left, and I'll ask them where that came from, and they said, well, somebody dropped it off for me.
Uh-huh.
These are wonderful things that are happening.
There's one concern, however. I know that it is difficult and frightening to approach someone who doesn't seem responsive. But sometimes if you do take the time to actually ask them how they are, you find that what you think you're seeing isn't really the whole picture. Our group recently helped to hospitalize a man who was living on a vent on Walnut Street. And from the street, he seemed like he was surviving. And certainly we could tell that there had been passersby who were feeding him. However, when we approached him and talked to him, he told us that his feet were hurting. And when we asked him to show us his feet, he did. He did, you know, willingly. And he had serious gangrene, which really would have caused him to lose his feet if treatment hadn't been given right away. And he was understanding that he needed help. He said that he needed to go to a hospital. He knew that. But he was so delusional that he kept telling us that he was waiting for his son to come and take him to the hospital. Well, as as we later learned, of course, he has no children, and that that really is a delusion. He did want help. He didn't know how to ask for it. And I think that most people, without looking a little more closely, wouldn't have realized how really much in danger he was at that point.
No, I think that one of the things that makes it difficult to leave some coffee or leave a burger for someone on the street is that you feel like if you've made that one step, then you've got to make the next step. And how much are you going to be asked to do? Will it become harder to face the person once you've made some commitment to them when you walk by the next day than it would have been if you could remain anonymous to that person? And will it require more of you than you can really give? What do you think?
I think that's right, and I think that's why it's so tragic that the mental health system isn't responding better, because it seems to me that you should be able to, when you see a person in distress like that, not have to assume personal responsibility for them, but be able to call someone whose job it is to take care of such people. You know, unfortunately, as we've talked about here today somewhat, it really is difficult to get the system to respond. And that's partly the people in the system are frustrated as well. I mean, if there is no hospital bed for a person like that, then it you can see why the system becomes frustrated too.
Mm-hmm. I also think, if I might mention, the police, who do an outstanding job with these people, have clothed many, have transported many for me, and incidentally, sometimes illegally, to get the help in another county, are so frustrated it's beyond one's imagination. It's just they want to help so much and know that this kind of individual who's not violent to self or others, but who is in need and unable to care, will not be given the kind of help that's needed. In New York, just this past week, I interviewed about 8 or 9 police officers with my own supervisor, and they said it's impossible. These people can be in the street raving and running after newspapers without practically nude and be so disorganized and crazy. And if we take them to Bellevue, the only question asked is has the person tried to kill himself or anybody else? No, and they laugh us right out of Bellevue. Bellevue's overcrowded. Manhattan State Hospital isn't taking patients back. Consequently, there are 120,000 of these people in Manhattan, either in sleazy one-room occupancy hotels or in the subways or in the catacombs or any place imaginable trying to survive. And for one to say that this is a better life for them, incidentally, than a state hospital is problematic, and I think that needs to be looked at a little more closely. By history, we know that these places were human warehouses of miseries. State hospitals traditionally were never funded appropriately. And the real heroes of our time in psychiatry were state hospital psychiatrists and attendants and nurses who, without any recognition ever, lived and died with these people day in and day out. I mean, it was just absolutely miserable beyond anyone's imagination. So today we take some comfort in saying, well, we've gotten all these people out, but what we've given them is just abandonment, and I don't think that's an answer to what existed. Even though that was terrible, for one to say this is better is not correct.
So do you think, I'm thinking of R.D. Lang now and some of the romance of psychosis, how mm-hmm. how psychosis is an exhilarating and creative experience. Mm-hmm. I'm probably doing a lot of injustice to R.D. Lang here, but so I apologize.
That's okay.
But I think that there was a lot of romance of psychosis as being a kind of creative sure. statement. Do you think that existed, and is this kind of retrenchment maybe a swing of the pendulum in the other way?
I think it is, and I think I've read all of Lang's work, incidentally, and he says many wonderful things. One of the difficulties, however, is to view schizophrenia as a breakthrough rather than a breakdown. Leaves an awful lot of questions. It's an awful, sad, despairing illness to exist in without intervention, and to wait for them to come out the other end, maybe never. The second problem with that is you can only appeal to a very small number of people if you operate like he did with Kingsley Hall and places like that. The bulk of these people, the hundreds of thousands that are in need, it would be considered almost malpractice not to intervene with psychiatric medications that do clear up hallucinations and delusions, that make them less terrifying and terrified, and to withhold appropriate kinds of treatments from them. Waiting for them to blossom out into a new human being is really, I think, missing the point at the most part.
One of the criticisms that I've heard during the past decade of state mental hospitals is that the treatment that's been given to many people with serious mental problems is one of a regular maintenance program of drugs mm-hmm. that keep them under control, but that's it.
Yeah, well, working in two state mental hospitals and investigating many others, I think it's safe to say that there obviously were many problems with the major tranquilizers that came out in around 1952 and 53. There are side effects, and there are some very dangerous ones, such as tardive dyskinesia, that is seemingly at this point is irreversible, although studies show that there may be a reverse to this soon. That's not saying that that's going to happen, but that's at least in the fore. However, if one examines the history of what these hospitals were like prior to tranquilizers and knew the horror and the murders and the beatings and the chaos and the straitjackets and the seclusion rooms where they never got out of, and one would examine a hospital today where medication is appropriately and properly administered, the people are approachable, psychotherapy can be initiated in many cases. Some can leave the hospital for more productive lives, incidentally. All is not negative in this. And to want to throw all that out because of these problems would be like getting rid of penicillin, although one might very well die from penicillin.
Pam, you've worked in state hospitals. Does your experience concur?
Oh, yeah. I think that there's, you know, what goes on in state hospitals today is nothing like what went on in state hospitals 30 or 40 years ago. And I think that, you know, one thing people can do is visit. I mean, I recently visited Philadelphia State Hospital, and as much as you hear negative things about it, what I saw there was very positive. It was an attractive place, a place where people interacted both with visitors and the staff, and where people really did receive care, and where many of the people that I talked to didn't want to leave, and who do not see going to a boarding home in some poor section of the city as a step forward.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We're discussing street people, if you're just joining us, and I have three guests with me. Just speaking was Pam Kilman, who's a lawyer. With me also is Bill Eisenhuth, who's a founder of the Philadelphia Advocates for the Mentally Disabled. Pam is a founding member of that group. Also with us is Liz Robinson, who's the director of the People's Emergency Center, which is a shelter in West Philadelphia. Bill, you've done a lot of work in New York as well as in Philadelphia with homeless people. Can you compare the two cities and how people survive in both?
Yes. Of course, in New York, by sheer number, it makes it much worse. Just are not facilities that can take these people in. Treatment availability is nil for this specific population of people. And the men's shelter in the Bowery is just overloaded and overloaded with people who are perhaps more appropriate for a shelter than the kind of psychotic individual that's, you know, really disorganized and coming apart at the seams and needs psychiatric intervention. By sheer number, it's much worse, as I indicated. In fact, I would say from my study and my experience, Philadelphia may be one of the better cities in relation to the deinstitutionalized, which I should add not only talks about those put out, but those that can't get in. The Group for the Advancement of Psychiatry designates those two groups. So that the condition of patients or people would be similar in their level of functioning from very, very poor to fair, both in New York and Philly, but just the amount of people in the streets of New York and in the terminals and what have you is just so much higher.
How do the subway systems compare as far as the way they're used by people without homes?
Yeah. The subway systems are much more used in New York because there's just simply more of them and there are more places to hide. In Philadelphia, there are places that I won't mention for fear that they'll have to be chased again that are utilized safely and there's some warmth for people. In New York, the danger, of course, is getting lost underneath a subway station or platform and wandering out in front of a subway train, which has happened much more frequently than in Philly.
Winter's probably the hardest time to survive. Pam, are you able to keep up with who's survived the winter or who's died on a very cold night?
It's very difficult, partly because many of the people who die in the streets don't have any identification on them. And we have been in contact with the coroner's office, and of course many of these people come in just, you know, frozen, and they really can't trace where they came from. We think enormous numbers of the people who were deinstitutionalized, who ended up in the streets, have died in the winters. I might say that this is not a problem that's isolated to the people who actually live in the streets, but it's also a boarding home problem. Many of the boarding homes don't have adequate heat, don't have services for people so that if someone gets seriously ill, no one notices. And the numbers of people who die in boarding homes over the winter is very high as well.
Mm-hmm. There's been some news coverage of the street people situation in this city. Are you satisfied with the way it's been discussed in print and in the electronic field?
I personally am. I think the media has done an outstanding job in identifying the difficulties and pointing out possibly some of the solutions that exist, both TV and radio and newspapers.
Liz, what's your impression?
Well, I think it's just begun. I think the recognition of the problem is the first step, and the media is useful in bringing the problem in front of us. I think that hopefully the media can help also to seek solutions for the problem. I think that the first step is generating the energy and the interest.
Mm-hmm. We were just talking a second ago about keeping track of who's survived or who's died during the winter. I wonder how you cope with that emotionally, since all three of you, you're making contact with people who you know might actually be dead at any given moment. There's no support system that they can rely on, or no steady source of nutrition to keep them alive. So do you make a point of not getting too close or not allowing yourself to care too much? Otherwise, you'd have a lot of suffering to do every day. Liz, the People's Emergency Center?
Well, I've been sitting here thinking, as Bill has discussed, the problem of the deinstitutionalized, realizing that, as he was saying, the second group are those who are prevented from entering into the mental health system. The great dilemma in all of this is the collapse of the systems that are here and in place, which either do not have the resources, the financial and personnel resources to meet the problem, and therefore don't seek to address it. But we see at the People's Emergency Center a population which is not, in addition to the mentally ill population, we see a population that you could not really describe as mentally ill, but who are becoming chronically homeless through the collapse of the same systems that deny entry to the chronically mentally ill. And that population, for me, to see a process of deterioration over a period of time is the most difficult. Because many of these people are really human beings that are just like the old lady next door, who over a period of time loses her financial base and is thrown into the population of boarding homes, and through the mistreatment that Pam alluded to in boarding homes, finds herself on the street more and more often. And that kind of becomes habituated to being without a permanent place. And that, simply that, becoming habituated to being without a permanent place, a permanent home, is a very disorienting and very disconcerting and kind of rips the pride from someone who for most of their life has lived a fairly normal life. And personally, when you ask me the question of involvement, personal involvement, I find that hardest to witness.
Bill, how do you cope?
Well, I suppose I started so early with this interest in the chronically mentally ill as a teenager, and it just became such a part of me. I've never really sat and thought through the suffering in relation to how I would deal with it, but other than just simply being with the person that was there. And I think that's probably what we do. If we're confronted with one, that's the one we'll deal with, and we can't really envision the mass of people that are in such serious trouble.
I think that the members of our group, that's really how we got started, was by feeling so personally upset about the situation that many people find themselves in. And I think that a lot of us handle it just by doing something. I mean, if you can give someone something to eat, or if you can give someone something to wear, a pair of gloves or something that they need, at least you can feel like you've done something about the problem. And I think there's a place for that with everyone. I mean, I think that anything anyone does.
I think one has to be careful of rescue fantasies and being motivated out of guilt with this, because that can overwhelm people. And I've had a barrage of people that have wanted to go out and help me now since the newspaper article. And as I interview them and talk to them, I can tell that it's the compulsion to have to do this now. And I'm afraid that with awareness, often a lot of guilt will come along with it. And I think one has to be careful that we don't operate out of that. That can get in the way. And then you start doing something to the patient or the person rather than being available and being someone that can work with them. And that's what I see my role as in Philly with the patients, being with them. And I feel it's much more important, incidentally, to build the relationship than I do to give them a pair of gloves, incidentally, or food. Once that human relationship is encountered and established, I think it brings meaning into the desolation and despair that this person exists in. Food is really secondary, although that's certainly important for survival, obviously.
In the struggle that you're going through now, trying to help keep people alive and trying, I guess, in your way to overturn some of the overturning that's been done in the mental health system, who do you see as being your opposition and who do you see as being your allies in the struggle?
Well, I think the major problem is the whole philosophy of deinstitutionalization and that it's just rolling so hard and fast that no matter what one said logically or could prove statistically now, it wouldn't stop, and certainly I'm not looking for it to stop. So I see that whole philosophy that operated out of really deep feeling for the dilemma of the state hospital setup as being one that's the, if we could use the word, enemy. I don't want to come off sounding like I don't want people out of hospitals. I want everyone out of a hospital that can possibly function and live a life where they are finding some meaning. I think what we're saying is the enemies are those who, when they see this misery and identify it as illness, both physically and mentally, and turn their back on it and refuse, I think they're, wittingly or not, are the real enemy. And they come from various sectors.
We're in a period now when drastic budget cutbacks are in the works. What do you think this the effect of this will be on the mental health system?
Well, I don't think it's going to help, but I do think that there are things that could be done, especially short range, that would improve the situation vastly. For one thing, you know, Philadelphia State Hospital has gone from a population of 6,800 people in, say, 1968 to about 800 people now. And the space is certainly still there. And when there are no beds in the private sector, we certainly feel like it would be really a help for a person who's in a crisis or in really serious physical situation to be able to get in at least temporarily. And we've certainly pushed hard for the state to be willing to take direct admissions to Philadelphia State Hospital when there are no private beds. And this is something that's done in all the surrounding counties and not in Philadelphia. And so I think that even with the fiscal crisis, there are things that could be done that would help.
Do you have any additional things you'd want to?
Yeah, I think the situation is complicated with the closing of PGH, if we're all familiar with the Mills building and the reception center, where these kinds of people could be brought in and triaged and their needs could be met or discovered and sent to the appropriate facility. All of us who understood chronic schizophrenia and understood the needs knew when Rizzo closed PGH, the private hospitals were not going to open their doors to these people. So we've been pushing on the state and the city to perhaps give us beds at the Eastern Pennsylvania Psychiatric Institute that was just given over to Women's Medical College, or Pennsylvania Medical College, lock, stock, and barrel. And if we could get emergency beds, maybe 40 beds, that would be a start for police and others like myself to, you know, see a person severely debilitated, could bring them in and get them help.
Liz, what do you think the budget cutbacks effect will be on mental health and emergency care?
Well, it's the budget cutbacks in all social services will be interesting to see how the system is going to absorb that. I think that the feeling of despair is perhaps the worst thing you can do. I think feeling as though greater efficiency, more responsibility on the part of social service workers and the average person is a more appropriate response. I think that we're going to have to live with much reduced kind of social expectation in terms of the public sector, at least for the next decade. And I think the sooner we adapt to that and try to absorb the services, the better we will be. I don't think there's any point in lamenting about, you know, specific dollar amounts that are being cut. A lot can be done within even present levels and even reduced levels of budgeting to improve the quality of service. As Pam's allusion to the fact that the beds, still the same number of beds still exist at Byberry. It isn't a lot more expensive to fill those beds than it is to have them running vacant.
Pam, as a lawyer, do you think that laws need to be changed or added?
I don't think that the law is really at fault. I mean, the Pennsylvania Mental Health Act really was ahead of its time, and I think there is a real concern for not hospitalizing people who don't need to be hospitalized. But I think the law pretty clearly covers the kind of people we're concerned about. I mean, there is a specific provision in the law for people who really cannot care for themselves. I don't think it's the problem is not with the law. I think the problem at this point is with the system simply not responding. One thing that has become clear is that along with the process of deinstitutionalization came a theory that there had to be a revolving door sort of process. Certainly psychiatric patients have crisis periods. They may, even if they're functioning in the community, have a period of crisis during which they need to be rehospitalized briefly. And without that kind of revolving door working, then this whole system really breaks down. I mean, people have to be able to get back in. I don't think deinstitutionalization really ever meant for people to get dumped out and then have the door closed behind them.
Do you see the situation remaining basically the same, or do you see a terrible nightmare around the corner, or possible solutions?
Well, I don't see any solutions in the immediate future. This is a very malignant situation, and it's overwhelming in numbers. And most people in the mental health field are hoping that Pandora's box is not open too far, because what we're going to have to do then is become responsible again.
Okay. In the meantime, when you walk down the street and you see someone who's obviously homeless, and when you ask yourself, oh, now what can I do? What can you do? Mm-hmm. Any suggestions? Just recap some of the things that you said before.
Well, I think one of the things that would be very appropriate, if people would feel safe, to just approach these people and kneel down near them and ask them if they're hungry. Now, many people are going to say no. And you might ask them again in 10 seconds, and they'll say yes. There's a terrific ambivalence with these kinds of people. So you might get a response that would be negative and a positive very quickly. And if you have extra clothes, put a pair of gloves in your pocket or a sweater or something like that. And occasionally, if you see someone that looks very cold, you might establish that contact by offering that. I would suggest that you do it very slowly and not overwhelm the person by hovering over them. I really think it's important, not only symbolically to the patient's inner world, but just out of dignity. If they're sitting down on a vent, that you don't stand up over them. It's just more appropriate to get down to their level, and that's where they are. They're on the sidewalk or under the subways or whatever. Get down near them.
It's not inappropriate to follow that or to pursue that initial approach by asking them if they would like to stay indoors. And if you happen to know of the People's Emergency Center or Mercy Hospice or St. John's Hospice or another facility that can take them, or even a hospital emergency room, if they would agree to go indoors, then if you have the time to accompany them, that would be very worthwhile.
I know a lot of people are afraid of contracting a disease through direct contact with someone who obviously is suffering with many problems. Are there any precautions you should take?
Well, most of these people that I'm talking about have lice and have open sores many, many times, and probably other diagnosable diseases that I don't know about. I would just like to take issue with Liz on one thing about the emergency rooms. I find it very difficult to take a patient into an emergency room unless there's really going to be some forcible action and commitment or pushing the system to take them, because there's just simply so many that we could take up and take. Now, the emergency service, I understand, would be somewhat difficult to get this kind of person in that I'm talking about. Isn't that correct?
What, into the People's Emergency
Center? Yeah, I mean, the ones that are so crazy and so...
No, so long as the person... We accept people so long as they're ambulatory. Mm-hmm. If the person is not ambulatory and can't stand and can't walk, then mm-hmm. we could not take them. Mm-hmm.
But the level of psychosis doesn't affect the entrance there?
No, if the person is not qualified to be committed against their will, then we operate on the same standards. Mm-hmm. If they're not currently violent towards themselves or others, then we do accept responsibility to house them temporarily. Mm-hmm. And my main point here about getting them indoors to a facility that would at least begin to understand the problem and try to refer them to the most appropriate facility available, I think that's, in my mind, that's more important than one more hamburger.
Oh, yeah, if we could get it done.
Well, just getting back to the idea of any precautions you should take if you're communicating with someone, offering them food or driving them over to a hospice.
Well, I would recommend you do not drive them for several reasons. If you don't know the individual, there is, although these people should not be considered dangerous, most mentally ill people are simply not. In fact, they're victimized, if anything. But I would say that just from the sheer problem with insurance, should the person be injured in an accident, or perhaps lice in your car, or a physical illness that might, like a very bad virus or something, or something like that. And you never know in closed quarters what might happen either. I have had difficulties with people becoming acutely psychotic while I've talked to them, and I've backed away. But I would have imagined in a closed automobile that could have been more complicated moving. You might have leaped out or something.
So you would not recommend driving someone?
I have not. I always have police. I either go with the police in a van or they'll take them if it's appropriate on a 302.
Okay. Do you want to add anything? Anybody want to add anything before we
I think there's a real place for increased community involvement in groups and with churches. I might say that there's a group called the Boarding Home Advocacy Team, which is a coalition of churches and community groups, basically in Germantown and Tioga, but they're operating all over the city now, who have been visiting boarding homes and trying to help out with the problems in boarding homes, providing programs, sometimes food for these people during the day. Certainly our group would welcome correspondence or referrals from people, and I think that kind of private sector response is going to be increasingly helpful.
Okay.
Yes, I'd agree.
I want to thank all of you for telling us about your work and about your concerns on the situation of people who are homeless in our city. I've had three guests with me. With me has been Bill Eisenhuth, a founder and director of the Philadelphia Advocates for the Mentally Disabled, Pam Kilman, a lawyer who is a founding member of the Philadelphia Advocates for the Mentally Disabled, and Liz Robinson, the director of the People's Emergency Center in West Philadelphia. That's an emergency center for women, families, and couples. And if you'd like to give any phone numbers or addresses, whichever is appropriate, Liz?
Okay. Again, the number for the People's Emergency Center is 382-7522 or 21.
And is there a phone number you'd like to give for the advocates?
We'd give the address, certainly.
We can give the address, yeah.
It's the Philadelphia Advocates for the Mentally Disabled, and it's at 410 South 8th Street in Philadelphia.
Well, thanks.
That's not a walk-in center, by the
way. Right, right, right.
Just send mail.
Good enough.
Okay,
well, thanks.
Thank you very much.
To all of you very much.
Thank you.
It's 6 minutes after 3 o'clock, and this is Fresh Air on WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. This is a duet with Archie Shepp and Horace Parlin, and I'm sure you'll recognize the song.